Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LP 106.1 FM Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, January 21st, 2006. Our show today is entitled Civil Rights, MLK, Roe, and Palestine. Here's what we have coming up for you. In our first hour, we'll hear a talk given on January 19th, 2006 by Reverend Dr. Arthur Hilson in Portsmouth on the reality of Martin Luther King Jr.'s radical ideas. In our second hour, People's History celebrates the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, and we hear a view of Ariel Sharon by a Palestinian journalist. Today our news will also include the latest segment of Media Minutes, a weekly review of news at the intersection of media and democracy. We'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Connecticut, with stories on Iran, Alito, and more. We'll also have announcements, music, and more. So stay tuned. From WorldNet Daily on January 16, 2006. 52% of Americans say, impeach Bush on wiretaps. Zogby poll. Most want action if U.S. citizens monitored without judges' okay. A new Zogby poll indicates a majority of Americans want Congress to consider impeaching President Bush if he wiretapped American citizens without a judge's approval. Respondents were asked if they agreed or disagreed with the following statement. If President Bush wiretapped American citizens without the approval of a judge, do you agree or disagree that Congress should consider holding him accountable through impeachment? The poll found that 52% agreed, 43% disagreed, and 6% said they didn't know or declined to answer. Bob Furtick, co-founder of the left-leaning group AfterDowningStreet.org, which commissioned the survey, said, "The American people are not buying Bush's outrageous claim that he has the power to wiretap American citizens without a warrant. Americans believe terrorism can be fought without turning our own government into Big Brother." As one might expect, the respondents' political affiliation played a role in their answer, as 66% of Democrats favored impeachment, as did 59% of independents, but only 23% of Republicans. 1 month ago, one-third of Americans polled said they believed Bush should be impeached. From the Interpress Service on January 17, 2006, women's anti-war petition circles the globe. Eminent female writers, artists, lawmakers, and social activists in the United States are reaching out to women leaders across the world in an attempt to forge a global alliance against the U.S.-led war in Iraq. A U.S.-based women's group has launched a global campaign to gather 100,000 signatures by March 8th, International Women's Day, when they will be delivered to the White House and U.S. embassies around the world. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace, a California-based rights advocacy group that has spearheaded the global women's campaign, called Women Say No to War, said, "We are unleashing a global chorus of women's voices shouting enough." Describing the initial response to the group's call for signatures as overwhelming, Benjamin says that more than 200 high-profile women from various walks of life endorsed the campaign even before it was formally launched earlier this month. The signatories include popular film stars like Susan Sarandon, the playwright Eve Ensler, and comedienne Margaret Cho, and award-winning authors such as Alice Walker, Anne Lamott, Maxine Hong Kingston, and Barbara Ehrenreich. "We, the women of the United States, Iraq, and women worldwide, have had enough of the senseless war in Iraq and cruel attacks on civilians worldwide," reads the call. "This is not the world we want for ourselves or our children," it says. "With fire in our bellies and love in our hearts, we women are rising up, across borders to unite and demand an end to the bloodshed and destruction. Cindy Sheehan, whose son Casey was killed fighting in Iraq, and whose subsequent vigil near U.S. President George W. Bush's Texas ranch was one of the first signatories to the campaign. Urging a shift in the U.S. strategy in Iraq from a military model to a conflict resolution model, the organizers say they want to see a withdrawal of all foreign troops from Iraq with full representation of women in the peacemaking process in that country. Yanar Mohammed, a signatory to the campaign and president of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, said, "Iraqi women are devastated now. It will take us decades of struggle to regain a peaceful and civilized life." The U.S. occupation has planted the seeds of ethno-sectarian division, preparing Iraq for a civil war, and has blessed religious supremacy over and against women and human rights. If you would like to sign this petition, you can go to www.womensaynotowar.org. We finish up our 10 minutes of news with 5 minutes of Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
This year, the Congress is expected to take up a telecom issue that will determine the future usefulness of broadband connectivity in the United States. Central to this issue is a concept called network neutrality. This concept, according to Consumer Federation of America Research Director Mark Cooper, is well ingrained in U.S. legal and regulatory history, having first been applied to railroads in the late 19th century.
So if I wanted to move grain down from my farm to a silo and then to a port, the railroad was not allowed to discriminate against me, to say, no, I'm not going to move your grain. I don't like the color of your eyes or your skin, or you're competing with my uncle or my cousin. So they had to operate their networks in a neutral manner, a non-discriminatory manner.
In the early 1900s, Congress mandated telephone networks operate on the principle of network neutrality. But now phone and cable companies, most notably AT&T, Bell South, and Verizon, want to kill off this concept in favor of what they envision to be a multi-level internet. Under this principle, consumers would continue to pay for a fast connection, but websites and other online content providers would also pay a premium to guarantee fast transport over broadband networks. Cooper says a scenario like that would effectively turn the net into something that more closely resembles today's cable TV systems.
If you think about your cable system, the cable operator decides which programs get to be in that system. They decide, not the consumer. And that's what the telephone companies want to do.
The technology already exists to prioritize packets of data flowing over broadband networks. For example, packets associated with voice over IP telephone calls get priority over email traffic because of the real-time nature of talking on the telephone. Cooper thinks using this technology, called policy-based routing, will fundamentally change the way the internet evolves.
The next Google, the new guys, won't be able to pay this freight, so that they will literally strangle the flow of innovation that has been the lifeblood of the internet.
Cable and phone company lobbyists are working hard to convince lawmakers to abandon the principle of network neutrality in the broadband context. The FCC has already ceded its authority in this area. Chairman Kevin Martin says he'd rather deal with individual cases of data discrimination when they occur. The problem is that once such discrimination begins on a widespread level, it's very difficult to reverse. A first draft of telecom reform legislation circulated on Capitol Hill late last year contained language mandating broadband network neutrality, but on revision, that provision was removed. Mark Cooper says the concept has worked so well throughout history with old-school transportation and communication networks that it would be simply foolish to abandon it now.
We're making a set of decisions across all of these areas that will determine the structure of the way we speak and hear for generations. And sometimes we don't realize how important these decisions are. That's our job, to make people understand what's at stake. We can't have big corporations who own the wires deciding who gets to speak.
And it appears the majority of Americans agree. A recent nationwide survey by the Consumer Federation of America, Consumers Union, and Free Press found more than two-thirds of those polled worry about cable and phone companies blocking access to online content or being forced to pay extra for content they now get for free. A similar margin supports the concept of network neutrality, but less than half believe cable and phone companies will voluntarily adhere to this principle. The Senate's Commerce Committee will discuss net neutrality in a public hearing on Tuesday, February 7th.
Cable and phone companies are again trying to stifle the development of community internet projects in Indiana. Last year, a bill to completely deregulate phone service and ban public entities from building out their own broadband networks was defeated after cities, towns, and concerned citizens rallied to stop the legislation. But a new proposal would effectively ban the public provision of broadband unless a community agrees to undertake a cumbersome administrative process to prove that no private broadband options exist. In addition, this new bill would provide a host of tax and other financial incentives to entice cable and phone companies to expand broadband. These incentives, unfortunately, would most likely deprive local governments of property tax revenues.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Ain't gonna let nobody, Lordy, turn me around, turn me around.
That was New Hampshire women's singing group Femme Ami with Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Round. You're listening to Making Waves. On January 19th, last week, Reverend Dr. Arthur Hilson spoke at New Hope Baptist Church in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, on Martin Luther King's Dream of Peace. In it, he explores how King is viewed by society today versus his truly radical and controversial stances on economic justice and war, as well as civil rights.
I'm going to come to the king and peace, king and war, but I looked at the Portsmouth Herald yesterday, and something that they had struck me. If you saw it, on the editorial page, they talked about a great speech. How many saw that in the Herald? And the speech they called, I Have a Dream. Did anybody see that? Now, I my people know this, but I want to burst your bubble tonight. But let me ask this. How many of you heard Dr. King deliver the I Have a Dream speech in Washington, D.C. in 63? Raise your hand. Okay. Brother Edwards said he heard it. Uh-huh. How many of you believe that Dr. King delivered a speech entitled I Have a Dream from the steps of the Memorial in 1963? Raise your hand. Okay, that's good. Thank you. That's a lie. He didn't do that. Dr. King did not deliver a speech entitled I Have a Dream from the steps of the Memorial in 1963. I don't care what you've been reading, what you've been hearing, what the media says. It's a lie. Have I piqued your interest? Every year, around this time, they pull out a video, you see it on TV. It says, I have a dream that one day my four little children, you've heard that, haven't you? It's a dream. And I would submit to you that white America, in the 60s and even now, those in power, don't mind King's dream. But the real speech that King delivered there was a nightmare. Where you going with this? A nightmare. The next time you get a chance to look at the video, it's 17 minutes and 34 seconds. That's the speech. And if you look at the video, you'll see that he is reading from a manuscript. How many have seen that? You've seen the whole thing. And then when he says, we must go back to Mississippi, he picks up a refrain. He had just used in Detroit, Michigan, that summer with C.L. Franklin, and it used several times before. And the refrain was, I have a dream. That's a refrain. People love that. I have a dream that one day, oh yes, that's wonderful. A fellowship, yes. Country of the character, not a couple of kids, yes, that's wonderful. But go back and look at what he prepared and what he delivered that day, and he talks about a check, a promissory note, that America had been untrue to its citizens. That's the speech. And he was talking about, and this leads all the way through the kind of war thing in Riverside, all of that. It shows where Martin was going. And by the way, everybody loves Martin now. Except some folk in State House in New Hampshire, but that's beside the point. I'm going to come to that in a minute. Eric Dyson describes King as a man who is deeply human, deeply flawed, and yet truly amazing. In the last 38 years, we have trapped King in romantic images or frozen his legacy in worship. We pull out every year. And since his death, we've made three mistakes in treating King's legacy. First, we sanitized his ideas, ignoring his mistrust of white America, his commitment to black solidarity and advancement, and the radical message of his later life. King had a radical message in the last 5 years of his life. Radical. Revolutionary. It was as radical as Malcolm X. As radical as Whitney Young. Yes, but nobody wants to hear that. We like to have the dream. I have a dream. Am I talking all right so far? You see, today, right-wing conservatives can quote King's speeches in order to criticize affirmative action While school children grow up learning only about the great pacifists, not the hard-nosed critic of economic injustice. Second, we've twisted his identity and lost the chance to connect the man's humanity, including his faults, to the young people of today. Expressed our despised black youth. And find that we have ceded his control of his image, if you will, to a range of factions that include the right, the federal government, and his holiday, and even the King family themselves. And they've attempted, listen to me, they have the family. They've attempted to collect a fee for nearly every word the great man gave to the world. Some years ago, I tried to get a King played here in the state. And we almost got it passed, but they wanted too much money. The King family, every time you use his name or his image, they want money. They have an office called Office of Intellectual Properties in the King Center. Oh, yes. Can you be as radical in your view of social justice as Malcolm X and still win support for the white establishment? Yes. Can you dedicate your life to common good and still give in to your own sexual appetites? Yes. Can you be a creative master of language and rhetoric while sampling the words and ideas of others? Yes. Can you love white people and mistrust them at the same time? Yes. Can you despise the unjust distribution of wealth and use its fruits to feed your own people? Yes. Martin Luther King, a man who had as much in common with Tupac Shakur as he does with Reverend Ralph Abernathy, teaches us that we must leave our most strident beliefs behind in order to move forward. And I was tempted to write to the Herald, but it wouldn't do much. I want you to hear a few words that Martin gave in Washington that day. It said, 54 years ago, a great American, in whose symbolic shadow we stand today, signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came with a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. Now listen to this. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro is still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. And he goes on, and he goes on about this. He's laying a foundation. Now think about what he's saying. He's saying, America, you have been unfair to all your people. That you've amassed a great wealth. Think about this. The greatest nation and richest nation in the world. That we could pay farmers not to plant crops. Are you with me? We could spend billions of dollars on a war, but couldn't spend a paltry 100 on poor people. Some things don't change. I talk about this. How many remember when Pease closed in 91? How many remember when Pease closed? You remember that on that base we had families of the military who were there to defend this nation. And they had housing on the base. That our families of military people who were ready to risk their life lived in. In Newport, Rhode Island, they built brand new Navy housing and moved the fleet out. Now here's what gets me. that when I talk about this and others raise the issue, we have veterans in this city who served in Vietnam among the homeless. The government owns housing on peace. But here's the reply when you say, how and why can't we put people in there? They say it's substandard housing. The same housing that housed our military families became substandard. I asked the question, is the cardboard box a veteran sleeps in under the bridge, is that substandard? Are you listening? Our priorities are wrong. And Martin recognized that. And from this gathering in Washington, as he talked about the material wealth of a nation, he began to change his focus and looked at how we distribute the wealth. Who is getting the haves? Have and get more. The have-nots have little and get less. It's a nation, mind you, that can build up a forming enemy like Germany or Japan. Can do that. They can bail out corporations like Chrysler. Remember Iacocca? And by the way, it's okay to give corporate America millions. And we call it some sort of bailout money, or we have foreign aid. But when we give to poor people, it's called welfare. There's something about welfare that has a stigma attached to it. If you give a hungry family $50 and a pound of cheese and a food stamp and call it welfare and cry about what you give them, but send millions, anybody hear that? In foreign aid. Are you listening? Mm-hmm. Let me say this to you. We say we defeated Germany, but Germany is slick. They got us back in a pocketbook. They sent Volkswagen for it. We beat the Japanese. The Japanese today. Sony, Toyota, now Lexus. We put Native Americans on reservations this day. They got gambling casinos. They're getting back the money. Are you listening to me? But the poor, even today, people don't have health care, don't have decent housing. We price out the poor. Those who serve our community, we price them out. We gentrify. Let me, I ain't going there. Let me leave that alone. Let me come on back here. Amen. I have some concerns. But listen, he went on to say that it's obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note in so far as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check. A check which has come back marked insufficient funds. And he goes on later and says, we've also come to this hallowed spot to remind America, listen to this, to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. And he goes on and goes on and goes on. And then he says, there will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The powerful words. He said, the whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. And he goes on, I hope you get the whole speech. And he goes on, I just want to pick a couple things up there. He says, the marvelous new militancy, which has engulfed the Negro community, must not lead us to distrust all white people. Mm-hmm. And he asks you to be satisfied. It goes on. And then he says, go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of the northern cities, knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. And so I say to you, my friends, that even though we must face the difficulties day and tomorrow, I still have a dream.
There's a meaty goat that I like about.
It's a big difference, sir. You catch the difference?
I would agree. They like it. That's all you see. They won't deal with the nightmare. Give me my share of the American pie. We who have helped build this nation. And what King was looking at there was something that happened 100 years ago. The 60s was really what I call the second Reconstruction. I know I should be a no hit. You've been in high school, you know about Reconstruction, right? After Civil War, they had this period called Reconstruction. We're trying to bring a nation together. And black folks got the right to vote. Black men got the right to vote. And white folk got scared because black folk were voting. 22 black men had the Congress. One black governor in New Orleans. They got scared, so they started resisting that and put up, after the slave codes, black codes, KKK, to intimidate and stop them. 100 years later, Jim Crow laws. Still the same old thing. Now listen to this. Here's where we're going. He recognizes the shortcoming of the nation. He's looking now at trying to give us our fair share. And so the next major campaign, 5 years span, is to put together what we call a poor people's campaign to demonstrate to America how people are living in slums and ghettos and no health care and not being able to eat and go to bed hungry. But along the way, in that 5 year span. Now, Lyndon Baines Johnson loved Martin Luther King. And in 1965, we had another bill. Your eyes get a little heavy, son. Don't go sleep on me. I don't, you'll go sleep in my church. So, hello, Paul. Johnson liked him until he spoke out against the wall. He became persona non grata. Now, listen. King spoke in Ebenezer about the war. He spoke in Ohio about the war, but when he came to Riverside, not a white folk, media, here, he spoke about the war in Vietnam. Remember that Eisenhower had called this a military-industrial complex. He pointed out that the victims of American military might were often people of color. Now I hear people today saying, you know, Iraq is like Vietnam. When you think about where we've gone with war, we drop bombs on Nagasaki, on Hiroshima, we drop bombs, we drop bombs at people of color. We sent napalm to Vietnam, people of color. We're in Iraq, people of color. Now, it seems to me that the greatest nation in the world, with the FBI and CIA and NIA and BIA, can't find one man hiding in the caves. We never found weapons of mass destruction. But yet, with 100 people still in our midst, and a major deficit going on, no health care, we are short of money, all of a sudden, $80 billion, overnight. You ain't with me. $80 billion overnight to kill folk in Iraq. 2,000 families are suffering right now, over 2,000 because of Iraq. Young lives being snuffed out, ill-equipped, poor equipment. Now listen to me. There's something about our mentality. Now, I this is not true. If somebody says something about oil, I don't. Yeah, you know, we don't want no oil. We just good people. We don't need oil. We're invented people. I think about these things, and they trouble me. Someone said, "Well, what would Dr. King say?" Well, if you understand King, he would say the same thing. That today, look at the money we're putting into killing people. And look at who we're ignoring. Let me give you another thing. They say that Social Security might not be around in a few years. See, my first president was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. My first president. Yeah, see, I'm 70 years old, so you don't remember him, Franklin Delano. But they
The people who make the law, now help me, you're in school. I think those people in Washington, there's a strange word I remember from history, and I think the word is representative. Is that what it is? And if I understand this, that when we did the Constitution, they have a bicameral document that two houses there, and the upper and the lower, and the upper two from every state, but then the representative in the lower house represents the people. Now, that's what I think I meant. What kind of retirement do they have in Congress? Oh, well, they don't draw Social Security. They can draw income for life. I dare say, if congressmen and senators were put on Social Security, they'd find a solution.
Amen.
But think about it now. But they don't worry about it. They debate it. They talk about it. But they don't do anything. Now, I'm just kind of, be with me, I'm kind of pulling these pieces out of the air. America still has misguided priorities. You follow that? Maybe we need to become involved and deal with those so-called representatives. We need to be concerned about these young people, about the Supreme Court and nominees. Because when you have someone in the White House who has a perspective, he's going to get people that share his perspective. The implications are frightening for women and poor people. What will happen when those folk sit on the bench and are there for life? I'm just putting pieces together now. I'll bring this thing home. King, where were you going? Well, I was trying to say to put an awareness on the nation about what we are doing, who we are hurting. You know, you take one bomb for one catch them, $1 million. One bomb. You pretty good at that? Judgment. $1 million. One bomb. How many families could be housed and fed? How many people could get health care for one bomb? Think about that. We have the resources to eradicate homelessness, to provide health care for those who need it. We can do that. Why is it we don't do it, I wonder? What's the problem? Let me give one more image. Are you ready? I want you to see three circles, their faces. I'm drawing them, I draw them. Whoosh! A face with a smile. Category one. Whoosh! Second circle. Land look. Category two. Third one. Sour looking. Three categories. Category one, the smile, or those who make things happen. Category two, the bland look. Those who watch things happen. Category three, the sad look. Those who wonder what happened. King was in category one. He spent time in two to look at what's going on, but then became involved in trying to make something happen. If you want to honor King, become involved in trying to create a better world for its citizens. So let me tell you something. Everybody on the bandwagon, we all love King. I said before, a lot of you didn't. When King spoke at this war, the man who headed the oldest civil rights organization in the country, the NAACP, founded in Niagara in 1909, Roy Wilkins, opposed King. King, you're wrong. The first black senator since Reconstruction after the Civil War, Edward Brooks from Massachusetts, opposed King. Every champion of the world,
Floyd Patterson. Oppose King. Jackie Robinson, hero. Oppose King. King don't speak out against the war. It's not American. It's all right to talk about civil rights, but don't talk about the war. You're not a politician. But King said, I am a preacher of the gospel. Injustice anywhere, injustice everywhere. And he declared the word of God. He said in Matthew chapter 5, verse 44, that we are to love our enemies, pray for those who persecute and speak all manner of evil against us. Pray for them. And Reverend King be for peace. Because in war, somebody's going to die. And every life is precious. There's a man 120 some years ago, John Donne, if I can paraphrase his words, he said that no man is an island to himself. Every man is a part of the main. He said, the death of any man diminishes me. Ask not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. And if you're going to honor King and have these gatherings, these rallies, and these parades, know who King was. Was not a dreamer. He was a practical, radical visionary who spoke against the injustice of a nation, who oppressed and denied a people who were involved in building this nation. But somebody didn't want some folk to be free. History tells us that when we had the Emancipation Proclamation, 12th, 13th, 14th Amendments, we had this thing that said, black people, you're free. 80 million, you're free. Free to do what? To go where? I had no schooling. If you try to even read it, they kill you. Where do I go? Well, the plantation owner had an answer. You worked for me before for free, but now come on, the thing they call sharecropping. That crop means, sister. I'll give you my old slave quarters. You can stay there. And if you tend to the fields, I'll give you a parcel of land to work on. And at the end of the year, we settle up and you get a profit. In the meantime, I'll give you seed, a shanty, and a mule. And you come and see me in my store and I'll put it in my book. What you owe me. And when harvest time comes and the books are checked, I can't read, I can't do figures, Mr. Charlie, how did I do? Well, you didn't do bad, but you still owe for this and this and this, so you were indebted to me for another $300. Don't worry about it, you'll make it next year. And so they kept the freed slave in bondage through sharecropping. Into the 60s, in Alabama, Mississippi, sharecropping. King spoke against that. And so the war had implications for poverty. Because Lyndon Baines Johnson had a thing called War on Poverty. I remember that. He had the Great Society. Kennedy had Camelot. God had the Great Society. But the Great Society, the War on Poverty, was like a kind of a mild discourse. Pennies for the war. It wasn't even a skirmish. But over there, where 58,000 lives were lost, and we firebombed babies, burned down villages. We had an Eli, and we had to get somebody, so we brought a little lieutenant called William Calley to make him the scapegoat. Captain Medina, who's his captain, got away and beyond him, but Calley. Atrocities that occurred in the name of war. And so King said, we need to look at where we are. As he began to move toward his campaign, the Poor People's Campaign, he went to Memphis for poor people, sanitation workers, who have been denied benefits. And the night before he was killed, he spoke prophetic words
Then he had a vision. So I've been to the mountaintop. I looked over. I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but one day you will. And the next day he was dead. He knew, as Malcolm X knew, his days were numbered. And so the legacy of Martin is not in a dream, but in a nightmare that must become a reality. We must not be in category 3 wondering what happened. If you don't do anything, you have no right to ask what happened. And so my hope is that those involved in the peace movement, and I came by Friday night and one woman stood by the church there at the Market Square, one woman, bless her heart, she had a sign, one woman. One woman. Friday night. And we must go beyond waving banners and showing signs. We must be able to stand up and speak up and not be afraid. Because Malcolm said, as Martin said, if you have nothing to die for, you have nothing to live for. Behind me is my wife. And we have 3 children, granddaughter, and I would die for them. Now catch this. As your parents would die for you. If they would die for you, then they want to live for you. As Malcolm said, if you have nothing to die for, you are better off being born a blade of grass. And then the cows can eat you. And McDonald's can have burgers. So let me get out of here. There's so much I could say to you. But maybe we can have some discourse. I do want to look at some words from that message at Riverside. He said, a time comes when silence is betrayal. Some of us, in his word against the war, have already begun to break the silence of the night. We found the calling to speak is often a vocation of agony. But we must speak. We must speak with all the humility that's appropriate to our limited vision, but we must speak. He went on to say that over the past 2 years, I've moved to break the betrayal of my own silences and to speak from the burnings of my own heart. As I have called for radical departures from the destruction of Vietnam, many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. At the heart of their concerns, this query has often loomed large and loud. Why are you speaking about war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voice of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. Aren't you hurting the cause of black people, they say. When I hear them, though I often understand the source of their concern, I am nevertheless greatly saddened, for such questions mean that the inquirers have not really known me, my commitment, or my calling. Indeed, their question suggests that they do not know the world in which they live. In the light of such tragic misunderstandings, I deem it of signal importance to try to state clearly, and I trust concisely, why I believe the path from Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, the church in Montgomery, Alabama, to where I began, my pastorate leads clearly to the sanctuary at Riverside that night. And it goes on. He says, tonight, however, I wish not to speak with Hanoi and the MLF, but rather to my fellow Americans, who with me bear the greatest responsibility in ending a conflict that has exacted a heavy price on both continents. And since I'm a preacher by trade, I suppose it is not surprising that I have 7 major reasons for bringing Vietnam to field my moral vision. And I won't go into all those, but I hope you have the tenor of that. He laid out some things. I will be one. My third reason, he says, is moves to an even deeper level of awareness. For it grows out of my experience in the ghettos in the North over the last 3 years, especially the last 3 summers. I've walked among the desperate, rejected, angry men. I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I try to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the change it wanted. And their questions hit home. He said that, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghetto without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. And that's when Johnson turned against him. One last part of that. Now it should be incandescently clear that no one who has any concern for the integrity and life of America today can ignore the present war. If America's soul becomes solely poisoned, part of the autopsy must read Vietnam. It can never be saved so long as it destroys the deepest hopes of men the world over. I want to share some words from that noble bard of yesterday, James Russell Lowell, who said, once to every man and nation comes a moment to decide. In the strife of truth and falsehood, for the good or evil side, some great cause, God's new Messiah, offering each the bloom of light, and the choice goes by forever twixt that darkness and that light. And though the cause of evil prosper, yet this truth alone is strong. And though her portion be the scaffold, and upon the throne be wrong, and yet that scaffold sways the future. And behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. I thank you. How many of you want to be in category one? Especially young people. Get involved. Because many of us, we are on our way out of here. We've left you a terrible mess. You really have. You can do better. I hope you can.
That was the Reverend Dr. Arthur Hilson speaking in Portsmouth, New Hampshire at New Hope Baptist Church on Thursday, January 19th, 2006.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.